the magazine, Arts and Architecture.
Yeah, yeah.
And we didn't have much leisure time. We were always already working. When I say we, frequently I will say we because Conrad and I, and as we became partners, we made it a point to never say I did this or I did
that. Oh, really?
It was just so frequently I will say we, even though Conrad was not involved. But that's just a force of habit.
Okay.
But I was, you know, so busy doing our thing, teaching and designing and building. And so even though we read it religiously, and we also like the Sunday home section in the LA Times, and it really had some, it was a great magazine, and always wonderful, innovative things in there, and it was very thin with a lot of knowledge in there. So we joined partnership with Straub, and pretty much automatic right away, Saul Bass and his wife bought a lot up in the Altadena area, and I think it was Cal that had the contact with John Intenza. Mm-hmm. Cal was quite a bit older, not a lot older than Conrad and I, but he was been around. He was our professor, of course.
Right.
But we all felt about the same age, but he had a few more contacts, and I think he had made the contact with Bass and was probably had been more familiar with Intenza than I was. And there was also the geographic, at that particular time, I had moved to the west side of town, and Calvin Straub and Buff were still on this side of town.
Where were you on the west side?
I got married, and we're way out into why can't I think of the name of that right now? Beverly Glen.
Oh, sure.
Found a Gordon Drake house out there, fell in love with the house, and forgetting about all the distance involved, and found this great little retreat in Beverly Glen for the right price, and got married and moved out there.
What year was that?
Oh, it was, it'd be 58.
58. And what was it, your wife's name?
Dolores. Dolores Carrion. I knew that would come up. I mean, it's been C-R-I-O-N. But and anyway, Bass became a client, and somehow with meeting with John Intenza, we became case study number 20.
Right.
And we were also had been somehow working with Douglasford Plywood Association. These, and I can't remember all the details so much as that as I can with case study 28. Because having the three partners, always one or two are more involved than the others. And a lot of things that happened for a short period of time was because Buff and Straub were in this side of town and I was on the other side of town.
Okay.
And we had our offices at that particular time down on 7th Street.
So 7th and where?
In, down on 7th Street, 7th Alvarado.
Okay.
And so we designed the Bass House in conjunction with Douglasford Plywood. Innovative things like instead of using solid wood beams, we built up the beams with 2x4s with plywood skins on them. Mm. That would form a 4x12 beam. And then we, to give them more interest, we developed the vaulted ceilings,
right,
which are prefabricated and dropped into place. And there's a lot of detail and stuff to get involved with that. But we came up with a great site, and we had the only problem, the site was for all general purposes level, but there was a giant stone pine on it. So that became kind of the focal point of the, a very important feature of the house, and we designed it around it. And utilizing, of course, Douglasford plywood as the basic material, everything was wood, and then Saul Bass had designed a tile called Bass Relief instead of Bob Relief.
That's
and
funny.
So we used that as the one wall of the entrance of the house. And a lot of brick flooring and continuous blinds and lots of glass and post and beam. Because we were, at that particular time, everything we were doing was post and beam. Everything was modulated.
Were you self-referentially doing that kind of house so that it could be a case study house?
Well, that one, oh yeah, it was definitely, oh, that was preordained or preconceived or whatever. When it started off, not necessarily, well, after talking, that's where I was not involved.
Okay.
It is the initial meeting of getting Intensa and Salbass together. But we did the case study house, which was very successful, and it was very well publicized. And that was in many issues of the Arts and Architecture magazine.
Right. And Esther McCoy, she wrote about it in Case Study Houses 1945 to 1962, and she had a quote that I thought was interesting that I wanted to hear what you thought. She said that the architects of Case Study House 20, the three of you, said the factory-built house is always more pristine than the one with a freer organization. Factory elements direct certain design conclusions. Did you ever sense any limitation in using these factory elements?
Oh, no. No limitations whatsoever.
Not at all?
Oh, no. Actually, it made it much easier.
Really?
In a way, because everything was regimented. Everything was modulated. So we always worked on like an 8-foot module.
Oh.
All plywood. See, prefabricated materials were all 4 feet by 8 feet.
Oh.
So we would have post and beam 8 feet on center. So a lumber or a piece of plywood would fit exactly. And that was kind of the basis of all of our preliminary, all of our earlier homes. I've got some pictures which I'll be showing you. But by these photos you can see that by modulating certain good rhythms, developing whether it's a 4, 8, or 12 foot structural system, you get a pattern and a rhythm. It's almost like music.
Oh.
Instead of being arbitrary, you have 1 6 feet apart and then 7 foot and 12 feet and all that. It had a consistency about it, and things fell together architecturally much simpler. You see the consistency in this whole thing.
Sure.
And instead of a wall with a lot of little holes punched into it, this framework is the wall, and everything is transparent.
Huh.
So, I mean, it's a lot more elaborate than that, but this kind of shows what is involved. And I'll get more into detail on that later on with you.
Okay, that'd be great. And but, how it affected your future career, too, later on. That
yeah, we're influenced by the Bauhaus to a degree and Frank Lloyd Wright,
mm-hmm.
and the Japanese. And these are all part of our training procedure, but somehow we liked working on the modular system post and beam.
That's interesting. The case study movement has been described by one person as an exploration of how the principles of modernism responded to a regional context heavily shaped by the tradition of the arts and crafts movement. Did you feel that effect of the arts and crafts movement in your case study houses? Obviously they're very different.
Yeah. Not so much, because we really knew that in our early stages, in that we were somewhat neophytes, and young, and most of our clients were young and didn't have much money. We had very low budgets.
Oh.
And so we knew that we couldn't get into doing something as elaborate as the Gamble House, with all of the various structural techniques and the joineries and different materials and the craftsmanship and the joinery and the quality of workmanship. So it had to be much simpler to come in on budget. Because we were building houses, a lot of retract houses, of course, were like 2 bedrooms were $7,500 and 3 bedrooms,
$8,500. Wow.
And then we got up to $13,000. But then we did some individual homes. We've got one around the corner here that we built for $12,000,
huh.
Post and beam on a hillside. And $20,000. And so we really had some very low budget things to do. And the only way to build those and have them interesting and have them look like something other than just a tract house was to use this simplified post and beam system and getting a framework for low cost. And then you could start exploring things with inside-outdoor relationships. instead of just plunking a piece of building down on a piece of property and a garage back here and a pool over here, we started designing things so they flow and integrate to the whole property.
That does sound like an arts and crafts philosophy, the indoor-outdoor theme.
Yeah, well, I mean, I appreciated all the green and green work, and
yeah.
I would spend a lot of time. I'm a friend of the Gamble House, and Randall Mackinson, the former director, is one of my best friends, and Ted Bosley, who's the director now, is a very dear friend of mine, and in fact, we got the first Gamble House Craftsmanship Award.
That's right, I saw that.
So it was a great honor, and Sam Maloof is getting it. I don't know if you've heard of Sam Maloof or not.
No, he's one of the great,
fabulous craftsmen, furniture designer, makers in the world. He's getting it September, so you have to go.
Okay,
that'd be great. And he's got a great book out. He just had an exhibit at the Smithsonian, and he deserves the award more than anyone in the world. He's a fabulous guy, about 85 years old. Like a ox hard worker. Anyway, yeah, we're very much influenced by, like I say, Greeny Green, the Japanese, and Frank Lloyd Wright.
Which aspects of those are?
You can't really tell.
Just sort of the
just
feeling.
Every abstract, yeah. I mean,
yeah.
Otherwise, I mean, you can't say this or this or this because it's copying certain things, but just the abstract kind of way of some of the spaces and the use of materials and forms and excitement they create.
Huh, that's neat.
A lot of it depends upon how much money you have to use, and how much money you have, and the site and the client. And many factors involved.
Sure. You were at USC School of Architecture during some of its most influential years, but how have you seen the USC School of Architecture influence Los Angeles over your career here? Would you say that it has a big presence in your work and the work of other architects?
Well, I was very fortunate. I mean, my classmates of mine were Pierre Koenig,
yeah.
My classmate, and
yeah.
He certainly made a name for himself. And I don't know if you saw the latest case study book.
Yes, I have.
And he's got case studies 21 and 22 in there.
Mm-hmm.
He works, you know, he's a good friend of mine, and he works with steel and glass.
Right.
As opposed to us working with wood and stucco and all that. It's a different idiom, different approach, but we're appreciative of other things we've done. And then Thornton Ladd was a classmate of mine, and he did Norton Simon Museum.
Right.
When he was still a student, and a hell of a nice job, and he did a great house for his mother in San Rafael. And Bob Ray Alfenhauser was a classmate. But Bob is a little different breed, a hell of a nice guy and a clever man, but he doesn't have any particular direction. He'll do Japanese, French provincial, Cape Cod, you kind of name it. But Buff and I have always done strictly contemporary. You know, someone came to us and say, it was $1 million fee to do a French Regency. Couldn't do it.
You couldn't, or you wouldn't want to?
Wouldn't want to, wouldn't do it, because our reputation is based upon this particular type of architecture, which you will see as these
sure.
things progress, how our architecture has progressed from some of these pictures I showed you, where you can see all the structure exposed to this sort of thing, which is more sculptural in character.
Before we go on to some other things, I was just wondering, while you were at USC, was there a sense that the core of you who were there were really going to shape the future? Because so many of you went on to become famous. Was there a sense in the air that something really exciting was happening?
You can't think that way.
You can't?
No, I mean, you can't even, no, never. You just want to, do good things. You want to be successful.
Yeah.
And you just want to luck out and get some nice people, nice clients.
Sure.
And work hard. I don't think of it. I mean, there may be some people around that have great dreams of grandeur, but I just never dawned on me.
Huh.
Never.
I guess you were working too hard to think about that.
Yeah, but you know, it's. I can start to see what's some of those things kind of happening now, but
yeah.
it and Luc Van Meany working on the book and seeing a collection of things we've done over 50 years, and thank God we've stuck by our guns and tried to be consistent and not deviated from what our philosophy is. Very important. Mm-hmm. Which when I talk to students and of architecture or people that want to become architects and tell them how important it is and to not study, I mean, you can study history and all that sort of thing, it's kind of a background, but when you're creating something, not to count on things that have been done in the past, to try to be creative and do things that are of today or of tomorrow.
And why do you think that is so important?
Well, to be creative and not plagiarize and not just be doing something that's been done before.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's not being creative. I mean, anyone can be an architect or can design a house, or if it's just everything has been done in the past, you can just go to the library and want a French Regency, just to get out, or a Cape Cod, or just get a postcard, and you can lay it out, and that's, but that's not architecture, that's just kind of drafting service.
Interesting, huh.
Yeah, I feel very strongly about that, and that's why, you know, that if you look around, when you, the more you get involved in architecture, and you drive down the street, you see some good pieces of architecture, but you drive down the street, and most of it's in, their houses, and they're nice houses. They're nice houses and better houses, but it's all about the same sort of thing architecturally. They're pretty bad and pretty crummy and pretty corny, and people are easily satisfied. Mm-hmm. And of course, ironically, some of them are much happier in those sort of very traditional, conventional houses than they would be in something like this. But this is takes a different type of intellect. And rationale and study and sensitivity. I'm not saying all our stuff is good, but it's good for the clients. And
right.
All the clients we've had have been really very excited. I just, the other day I was talking to a realtor, a house we did for Ned Brown in Malibu about 30 years ago. We built it for $125,000 on the beach. I heard it was on the market. I called the realtor and he called me back. He says, "Don, congratulations. You should be very pleased. Put your house in the market yesterday and so one day and sold the next day." And I said, "Can you tell me?" And he says, "Well, I can't tell you exactly, but just under $3 million.
Oh.
We built for $125,000, sold for $2.9 million.
And what year did you build it?
About 30 years ago.
Oh my gosh.
Right down on the beach. And I mean, that's just not 100%, it's not 3,000 times what it costs.
Yeah, that's amazing.
But it has to do with Malibu and the you know, the generation and the people and the living habits and all that sort of thing. People are becoming more and more accustomed to contemporary, which is part of the whole reason or raison d'etre of doing what we're doing. More and more people like this sort of thing.
You mentioned that some people are maybe happier in what you would consider mediocre architecture. Why do you think that is?
Sense of security.
Uh-huh.
They're used to it.
Uh-huh.
They don't know how the hell to react to something that's unconventional. That's, uh-huh, you know, pretty obvious. And they're used to a shingle roof and a brick fireplace and a brass doorknob, a little chandelier. You may have all those. I don't know what you have.
I live in an apartment now.
Okay. But, you know, it's a typical thing. I mean, 99% of them, they're, you know, maybe the garage in the back, and they got a garage door. I mean, drive down the street, you see a garage door painted black and white, you know, a big X in it.
Oh, yeah.
And or the door's open, all the junk's exposed in the garage, or picket fence, and, you know, all the cornball things. And I'm not putting people down. I can understand it, but I'm in a minority and they're in a majority, so I mean that doesn't make me right. But I feel very lucky that there are enough people around that like the sort of thing that we do and have done. So.
Before we wrap up today, I wanted to just fill in where you were living. When you were at USC, you were in the fraternity after the second year. Were you living there?
Oh, I lived in a. I had friends of Conrad's, Webb's, William Webb's, two brothers, and their father was a principal at Lincoln Hamilton High School. They lived in Eagle Rock, and they had a garage apartment,
oh,
or a little great little room above the garage, and I somehow I was able to rent that like $40 a month.
Wow.
Just one big space with a great big space, a little kitchen, a little bath, and kind of a small sleeping room, and a big orange orchard right outside, right off, now the freeway's over at the 134.
Oh, okay.
But,
so it's not there anymore.
And that was, I was right in Eagle Rock, and about a mile from their office, so the only problem with that, when coming back from school at night, I would be dead tired, and I'd sometimes go to the office, and I'd supposed to go home, and sometimes go home, and I'd supposed to be the office.
Oh.
But that didn't happen too often, but that was where I spent most of the years at time.
At USC.
Yeah. I'd never lived in the house. I knew that was impossible to live in the fraternity house.
Why?
Oh, it was just too much going on.
However,
as it was, when I was in the fraternity, because of being an architect and studying architecture, and they used to have the big parades and had built floats in my day. So I designed four different floats for my fraternity and got grand sweepstakes one time.
Wow.
Of course, I almost flunked out of architecture because I had to devote so much time to it.
Which parade did they?
Well, they used to have a parade down Wilshire Boulevard.
Oh.
I used to make those floats 30 feet long, and I built them on a Jeep, and I'd have to get it up, and I had to walk it up at one time to Miracle Mile, Wilshire Boulevard,
yeah.
And how I did that, I'll never, and they had a big parade, and all that, and that's a long, long story, but yeah, that was a big deal back then, but it just became impossible after a while. That was 48, 59, 50, 51, 52.
What was the name of the parade, do you know?
It was just the SC Homecoming Parade.
Okay. Gosh.
Homecoming, yeah.
That's amazing.
Big, big deal, and I also worked on the stunts. They did the card stunts, and that just took a tremendous amount of time.
What kind of stunts were they?
Oh, you don't remember the card stunts where they all lean over and all the students come up?
Oh, those where they hold up things to spell out words.
Yeah, and they have Trojans, and they spell over, go Trojans, and all this sort of thing. It's take thousands of hours of time to do that because each student has to come up with a particular, they have four boards with a different color on either side, so you have eight colors, and in front of them they have to, for trick two, have to come up with the blue or the green or yellow, and you have to go down and they say okay, down below they say over trick two, and you know, what color, and then you all come up, and that forms a great big, a lion running, or a Trojan, or a Trojan horse, and it's unbelievable how you could do it in finding the time.
Wow, that's pretty neat. So you had some school spirit going
there. Oh yeah, I was a Trojan, a knight, and all that. So I got and a fraternity member, along with all of the other things. How I did it, I do not know how.
20
hour
days.
I was actually vice president for the fraternity at one time.
Wow.
Probably didn't do too good a job.
Because you were so busy.
Yeah.
So from 52 to 58 or so, where were you living? Before you got married, after you got out of college, where were you?
I think I stayed at a garage apartment.
Uh-huh.
Oh, then I got involved with some kind of, with a builder that, and I don't know exactly how I did, but I found a house. I'm trying to get things straight here, but I got involved with a builder who did a lot of spec houses in Hollywood Hills.
Oh.
And he would get them up to a certain point, and I would move in and do some finishing touches to them, carpet them, and put some sparse furniture in them.
Oh.
So I'd kind of finish them off, and he'd sell at a great profit. By that time, he'd build another one, and I'd move to that. So I must have moved, I think, 15 times in a period of time.
Oh, in a couple of years?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And these great houses, great views, and all that sort of thing. And a lot of work, and every time I did, I thinned out stuff that I had moved, so I had less and less to move. I'd forgotten all about that particular period.
Who was the builder? Do you remember his name?
Oh, Jim Logan.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and he's maybe still around, I don't know, but... I didn't design the first ones. He had some drafting service. They were just what you call houses, but a lot of glass, modern, but pretty very inexpensively built on cheap labor. At the time, they were finding all those lots up in the hills were impossible, and he'd build these houses on them. We designed a one or two for him, but then we found out that he wouldn't follow our details and do them as well as we wanted. And then we were a little too expensive for him. Most contractors just wanted, you know, drafting service, drive something real quick and build it quick and get out, mm-hmm. make money. So we didn't do too much for Jim, and he kind of, that's way back.
Yeah.
But it was quite an experience. And then there was a period when a friend lived in the Schindler house on the west side of Silver Lake.
Yeah.
And in between houses of some sort, I rented a room there. I was able to live there for not too. And then there were two or three chaps. It was a very big place. And then another friend of mine who was a film editor bought a lot and built a house on Fernwood, not too far from there.
What was the name?
On Fernwood Street, we built found a lot for a pretty reasonable price and built a house there, and then sold it. It was kind of a spec thing. And then...
Did you get married then? Go to Beverly Hills?
No, the marriage was before that.
Oh, that was before that. Yeah, so you lived with your wife in that room?
Yeah, no. Marriage didn't last too long. It was a pretty short marriage.
How long did it last?
Well, it was a little over a year.
Oh.
Well, the problem was with that, it was, she was, and I love animals, but
yeah.
She had a poodle, standard miniature, and a toy, mm-hmm. and she liked to raise them, and there were nothing but dogs all around, and food, and all other, it just didn't work out.
Oh.
It's a long story, but the good news is that after the divorce, she married a veterinarian.
Oh, thank goodness.
So she is very happy.
Okay. Oh,
because she's got all her dogs, her vet, as a husband. So that worked out fine.
That's great.
Well, that was part of my life. It was fun. Anyway, it's enough of that.
And we'll pick up with this next time, but do you remember what year you moved to Pasadena? Or did you?
Yeah. About 15, 16 years. Before that I built Domus. I found a great lot up in Mulholland, mm-hmm. and I'll show you, there's a great house, Domus, and I'm going to do the ultimate bachelor pad. I was doing a lot of work in Beverly Hills, and we were doing pictures for, homes for Lawrence Harvey, the actor, and James Garner, and Steve McQueen, and all that, and so I was very busy in the west side of town, and those people. And I found a site right on top of a pad overlooking San Fernando Valley and back to LAX, and planes going in LAX and coming in out of Burbank. So I built Doma Solaris, and I sold that, and then I had a couple of interim houses until I found another lot over by Universal City. Uh-huh. I call that Doma's Dose, and I built that.
Was that on Mulholland too, near Universal?
No, that was on off Barham.
Okay, sure.
Looking, do you remember, Universal, look right in Universal City, that picture with Tony, or the Gates Motel, what was that picture? Anyway, look right into the ghost house, or the big house, that, and a great view, and I lived there for about 5 years, and I sold that, and then just by chance, we'd had a great party many years before at a house right behind the Gamble House that Irene Wright and her husband lived in with their three children, and her husband had left her some years before, and Conrad and his wife and their kids had kind of grown up together. Conrad informed me that she was about to sell it. And I remember the great space, it was like a lodge, and it was right behind the Gamble House.
What was the street?
Arroyo Terrace, mm-hmm. and Scott, right in the corner. Mm-hmm. I went over there, and Irene was a good friend of mine, and she said, yeah, I had an offer on it. but you offered me more and you can have it. And so I offered 10,000 more and it's yours. And so I got this great house.
Wow.
About 16 years ago. And then I left the outside as is and completely remodeled the interior of it. And it was, I was on a walking tour of the Gamble House. And we had like 10,000 people go through.
Oh my gosh.
2,000 people was.
2,000?
Yeah.
Okay. Great.
But how are we doing?
We're okay. I think this might be a good place to stop for today.
Yeah.
Great.